the Centre for Public Christianity. You're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Simon Smart.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Now, chances are in the past week or even today already, you've seen a Facebook post about Donald Trump. Perhaps you've even written one or responded to one.
So they say you shouldn't talk about politics or religion in polite company. But it seems that with social media, the rules of polite society get thrown out the window.
That's not to say that it's all bad. There are some instances when social media has been a force for good, and if you can believe it, an environment for civil, thoughtful discussion, even on politics and religion.
I came across a TED Talk recently. It's one of the best ones I've heard. It told a story of Twitter as a place where people can change their mind. The title? I grew up in the Westboro Baptist Church. Here's why I left. This is a little bit of what Megan Phelps-Roper said in her talk.
Initially, the people I encountered on the platform were just as hostile as I expected. They were the digital version of the screaming hordes I'd been seeing at protests since I was a kid. But in the midst of that digital brawl, a strange pattern developed. Someone would arrive at my profile with the usual rage and scorn. I would respond with a custom mix of Bible verses, pop culture references, and smiley faces. They would be understandably confused and caught off guard, but then a conversation would ensue. And it was civil, full of genuine curiosity on both sides. How had the other come to such outrageous conclusions about the world?
To help us make a little more sense of the world of social media and perhaps to offer some advice on how we can have good conversations on Facebook and Twitter, we've enlisted the help of Sarah Pulliam-Bailey. She's a religion reporter at The Washington Post and editor of The Post's Acts of Faith blog.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, I wonder if you have seen the language around how we talk about religion change in recent years.
Yeah, I'd say the advent of social media in the last decade or so has really changed how we talk about religion and who we talk about religion to. So, maybe in the past we saw our news sources as the Washington Post, maybe the New York Times or CNN, but now we have created these social media feeds that help shape what we read about and think about in terms of religion. So we might be cultivating sources from Facebook or Twitter or Tumblr or these other social media sites. And so we have our own communities that we're thinking about and talking to.
Sarah, you're really on the front lines running Acts of Faith, the religion section of the Washington Post. Talk to us about the comments section.
Oh, do we have to? Every article is kind of different, right? So we don't necessarily have a consistent, faithful fan base of people who are coming back and, you know, having these delightful, gentle, thoughtful conversations. I feel like people will read the headline, maybe read a paragraph, and then, you know, comment angrily, usually. And so the comment section is really tough. My theory is that if you have time to comment on articles, you generally are like reflecting some impassioned one, very far-sighted view, like either on the right or on the left. There are very few like thoughtful people who take the time and energy to, I'm going to have a reasonable discussion on this random article on the Washington Post website. I wish that were not the case, but I'm not hopeful about comment sections on websites. I think that more thoughtful conversations do take place in individual communities where you kind of know each other and kind of can assume similar things about each other. You don't have to start from scratch to get people to understand your point of view, if that makes sense.
Is there a difference between the kinds of comments that you get in the religion section and what you get across other sections of the Washington Post?
No, it's a great question. We have a weather blog that's enormously popular, and people are super passionate about the weather and like meteorology. They want to talk about weather patterns. And I'm not making this up. My colleagues who write about weather, they have like this huge fan base, and it's really interesting. But when I was talking to them, I was like, well, how can I replicate that when the conversations that we're having about religion often involve issues that people see as life and death or just very, very impassioned debates like abortion, maybe Israel, maybe healthcare, immigration. I mean, we're talking about very impassioned issues. And when people see religion, you know, is at stake, it's very difficult to have thoughtful patient conversation when you're already dealing with a really hot issue. So I do think it depends on the topic.
Especially since we live in an increasingly secular West, you'd think there might be less argument and emotion around this topic.
No, I think it's the opposite. Part of it that is, so we're, you know, seeing a more secular West, as you said, but we're, the world is expected to become more religious in the future. So part of that is due to Muslims who are expected to have a higher birth rate going forward than Christians. And so they're expected to pass the number of Christians in the next, you know, 50 years, I believe. And so as the West becomes more secularized, that doesn't mean it's, you know, separated from the impact of religion globally. And that's why I think we have these hot debates over the role of Islam in politics, or the role of Christianity in politics, for that matter. I think there's always going to be this question of how much should religion be intertwined in our political debates.
Sarah, do you think there are potential benefits as well to this sort of engagement about religion on social media?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, with any new fangled technology, there are going to be advantages and disadvantages, right? I think we're still sorting out what those are, but naturally you are able to make connections with people you never would have been able to. If you're feeling lonely, or if you're feeling like, you know, people don't understand you in your natural community, you can go online. And, you know, like, I became a mom a year ago, and I joined a Facebook group for moms. And, you know, I feel like I have this whole nother community of moms of 1 year olds, you know. So you're able to tap into these very specific groups and communities that I think, and religious communities as well. If you're a part of a faith, maybe that isn't in the majority, say a Sikh tradition or Muslim tradition in the US, like, you can find tons and tons of people who are like-minded online, who share your values, and you can start off conversations a little bit more quickly.
So Sarah, what about people who disagree? So social media can be great at bringing people together who have similar views or experiences. But for people who are kind of butting heads on Facebook or Twitter or wherever, are there benefits to those kinds of conversations, or do we just find them stressful and frustrating and wish they would go away?
Yeah, I think part of it depends on your personality and who the individuals are. For instance, I remember during the election when, you know, someone would post something that I vehemently disagreed with, I had this like stressful reaction, like, wow, I had no idea that friend believes that. Does that reflect something about me and that we're connected, rather than me thinking, oh, what? Let's have a thoughtful conversation and not heated and not impassioned and not, you know, it can drum up some of those like emotional feelings about who you are, your identity, and who you're connected to, because these are your Facebook friends, or these are your, you know, people you follow on Twitter, and you kind of trust them. And so if you see them post something you're not used to, or you're not, you know, you thought otherwise, it can be kind of jarring, especially with social media. Like, when you go to the Washington Post or the New York Times or these websites, you expect to be surprised. You expect news. You expect an element of, you know, something new will be told to me. On social media, you get a mix of like baby pictures and sentimental quotes and Instagram photos. You just get like a mix of things, and so it can be kind of jarring to see someone who has like a very impassioned point of view that you vehemently disagree with. So how do we have these conversations? I think it depends on the individuals, really. But especially when it comes to religion, like, if you're not of the same religious background, then what? Then you have to go and like maybe start from scratch.
Yeah, I've seen statistics that something like 31% of people have blocked somebody or unfriended them because of their political views or other kind of views that they have that they just don't want to see anymore. Do you think that's a problem in terms of we're just kind of shutting out views that we don't like?
I think you want a little bit of you want to be judicious about who are you listening to? Who are you paying attention to? What kinds of values are you allowing to, you know, infiltrate your world or whatever? Social media has helped us network with people based more on ideology, like as opposed to location or other factors. Like, I can be friends with people who aren't near me or not in my age group or not in my same stage of life. It can feel more diverse, but in reality, we can kind of cultivate these feeds that just, you know, they serve to fuel our own assumptions, and sometimes they can fail to challenge us and expose us to different points of view.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. Sarah Pulliam-Bailey, religion reporter at the Washington Post, joins us from New York to talk religion, politics, and keeping it civil on social media.
But before we get back to that conversation, here's our colleague Barney Schwartz, former religion editor at The Age, to share with us a little of his experience engaging with opponents on religion and politics in a digital age.
Social media probably felt liberating at first, but it's quite clear that it acts as a megaphone. People shriek into it much, much more violently than they would if they were face-to-face. We can have constructive political conversations in any forum, provided we're prepared to respect each other and not just want to dominate the conversation. For 5 years, when I was religion editor of The Age, I ran a blog called The Religious Right, WRITE, and it was amazingly popular. But the reason it was popular was because it was one of the few forums that atheists could come on and tell believers what they thought. So some of the language was very vituperative on both sides, unfortunately. I think in hindsight that I made a mistake by allowing it to be so freewheeling. But what happened was interesting. The haters would come on and make their points in the first day. But in the second day, when people calmed down, reason would prevail far more. Questions would be asked that underlay the issues and were quite revealing. I learned a great deal from my opponents in the course of that blog, which is very humbling. We really have to be much more patient with each other and recognize that we can learn from each other. We all have a view of what a flourishing society looks like, and those who disagree with me vehemently on politics generally start from a good motive, and that's what I have to recognize for the conversation to be fruitful. The best thing to do here is not to look at the actual crisis that you're disagreeing about, but the underlying assumptions. Why does your opponent think that such and such is a good policy? It's usually not because they're stupid or evil. It's because they have brought different assumptions, or more importantly, that they have weighted the assumptions differently. A survey that I read in Christianity Today just recently pointed out that conservatives value loyalty and sanctity, whereas progressives value fairness. Now, both groups value both things, but they weight them differently. The Bible, as so often, has very fruitful advice for us here. The most obvious example is to remove the log from your own eye before thinking about the speck in your interlocutors. And that's very surprisingly hard to do, and I think that all of us know that. Also, there's an interesting verse in Peter that tells us that even though Christians in the first century were subject to persecution and hatred, nevertheless, government was an institution of God and put there for our benefit, and we were to pray for and honour the king. Therefore, people like me, who regard Donald Trump as manifestly the most unfit person for president that probably has been in the history of the United States, nevertheless, God requires of me that I should pray for him and his welfare and his wisdom.
That was Barney Schwartz, former religion editor at The Age and one of our senior research fellows here at CPX. Let's turn to politics, Sarah. I wonder about the shift in language that we use to talk about that as well. Is there a big difference between online and offline conversations? It's certainly the case that people seem to say things online that they wouldn't say to your face.
Yeah, I mean, there are studies that show that people will never say something in real life to people that they would online, they'll gladly say. Part of that is just when you don't have to see their reaction, you don't have to see if they're hurt or offended or just like if they go and cry, like you're not personally, you know, seeing that in that moment. It can feel really good to get out your point of view. It's really hard because I think, you know, we are cultivating these communities and there's this like false sense that everyone is on the same page. And then someone goes in and like violates those values, that can be really, really hard, right? Like that. And how do you have those conversations about, say we have a different point of view on how healthcare should be administered. Like, can we have a conversation without it becoming about your, are you a good person, you know, or like, can we have a conversation about how the government should be run, how much money the federal government should be spending on foreign aid without people questioning like your faith as it applies to the poor and needy, you know, things. I mean, it gets really like, it cuts to the core of who we are and our belief systems.
Now, Sarah, I want to ask you about a phenomenon from 2008 and 2012 when Obama was being elected. Everyone was talking about the new evangelicals and how the evangelical vote was no longer so closely tied to the GOP, and there was an interest in a broader range of things. What happened?
I mean, the evangelicals are still kicking. We know that 80% of white evangelicals, I should say, voted for Trump. I think I have several theories that I'm kind of waiting for survey data to back me up on this, but I have several theories. I think, you know, evangelicals hated Hillary Clinton. You talk to any evangelical and they say they couldn't cast their vote for her. They saw Trump as the lesser of two evils. They saw him as, you know, the person who would ultimately deliver a very specific outcome they wanted, which is a Supreme Court justice who would be anti-abortion. And so all of those things combined created this atmosphere of like, Trump will do what we want. I think evangelicals are very pragmatic. They worship in what I think are kind of ugly worship spaces and not like these beautiful cathedrals, partly because it's cheaper. You know, they're willing, you know, they do a lot of pragmatic things. And I think we saw that in this election where they voted for Trump. And so it was interesting going leading up, speaking of social media, it was interesting to see the social media discussions leading up to the election, because there was a lot of anxiety and fear based on if you're willing to vote for Trump or not, you know, what does that reflect about your faith? And so I saw these impassioned debates playing out online all the time.
Thinking about the dawn of President Trump, is your impression that that has meant more vitriol on social media, or has it maybe jolted people into seeing that there are more sides than they were aware of?
Probably both, in that there was so much shock and anxiety and fear and frustration from people who didn't vote for Trump about, like, what does this mean? Is this, what country am I living in? Were there these people along and I didn't know it? I mean, there are a lot of accusations of racism. Like, are there secretly racist people? Like, is half the country racist? Like, all of this kind of anxiety was drummed up from the election, but also I think a realization a little bit of like, maybe I have been in a bubble and maybe I have only been listening to people who are like me. So I think it depends on the person, but I do think there is a desire for among some people for listening. What is it, you know, we live in a very diverse country, and not just racially and politically diverse, but just ideology and how people see the world. It's just a very different, you know, if you're in Alabama, it's a different world than if you're in Portland, Oregon. And so I think we're coming to grips with that in different ways.
Sarah, thinking about something a little bit different in terms of social justice and change, the term slacktivism has become quite popular. Can you unpack that for us and talk to us about what you think about this sort of online behavior?
Yeah, my impression or what I've seen with slacktivism is that, you know, you have someone who is very passionate about an idea, and so they might post an article about it, or they might, you know, pretend to be very focused on it, but in real life, you know, they might sign an online petition or join a campaign group or something like that, but or social media, but they, in real life, they're not doing a whole lot. Are they contributing money? Are they volunteering? Are they actually put, you know, boots on the ground? Are they actually doing something? I think what's interesting that I'm curious about, and I don't know the answer because I don't think we know yet, is right after the election, we saw so many protests. So, like, it was like every day felt like a new protest, right? Like, for, you know, after the refugee ban, after over immigrants, over like every, it felt like every weekend was a protest, a physical boots on the ground protest. I live in New York City, so I felt like there was an article that said protests is the new brunch. You know, joking about how brunch is so popular, but protests have overtaken them. And so I wonder with this recent kind of protest movement, you know, actually give money and time to causes rather than just like hitting like on Facebook.
So Sarah, finally, what do you think is important for us to be able to have better conversations about politics between friends and strangers, even enemies? And I wondered if you think the Bible has anything to contribute to that type of discussion.
The election in general made me think about, am I actually a good listener? I'm a journalist. I do this for a living where I get to ask questions. I get to probe these bigger ideas, but the election took me by surprise as much as it took a lot of people by surprise, but it made me ask, you know, am I listening? Who do I listen to? How do I listen? Do I need to be listening better? Because I think I listen. I think I read a lot. I think I consume a lot of, you know, diverse opinions. But the election really, I mean, I went out of my way to say, like, who else do I need to be listening to? What questions do I need to be asking that I wasn't asking before? And so that was my reaction. I don't know if other people have a similar reaction, but I think the more people listen on social media, the more like thoughtful conversations we can have.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Simon Smart and Natasha Moore. Sarah Pulliam-Bailey from the Washington Post has been sharing her wisdom and advice on how to talk about politics and religion well in life and online, and how you can still be polite and keep polite company while doing so.
If you enjoyed this conversation, you'll find more like it on our website, publicchristianity.org, or on iTunes. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. While you're there, do us a favour and leave a rating or review. It helps us know what you think about our show and helps other people find it. Next week, we're going to do our best to make you hear a painting. Join us then, see if we can pull it off.